Welcome to Physics and Religion, a series of podcasts exploring the significance of modern science to contemporary religion. I am your host, Dr. Albert Stets. We have been discussing human consciousness, and in this lecture and the next, I would like to take a look at computers. If it's true, as some people have claimed, that our brains are simply very elaborate computers, then a whole lot of deep philosophical questions become irrelevant. Some of you will remember Commander Data of the Starship Enterprise. He comes from the second generation series of the Star Trek films that ran on televisions for so many years. He looks like us, but he is different in several important ways. First, he is man-made, and in fact, non-biological. If you were to open up his service panel, you would find mostly computer hardware. He is what René Descartes would call an automaton. Second, his mental powers are vastly greater than any modern computer you can imagine. Third, he has no emotions. Despite this, he is a competent member of the Starship. He always acts ethically. He claims that he was programmed to do so. He is a consummate violinist, but he claims that he has simply memorized the playing of the great violinists of the past. He had a deep friendship with a woman, despite the fact that he claims to have no idea what it means to fall in love. Data raises some fundamental questions for us. There is an ethical issue. Should he be treated as a human being or as property? Then, is he conscious? So far as I know, no one ever asked him that question. If you were to ask him, I suspect that he would reply that he simply didn't understand the question. For our purposes, the big question is this: is Data possible even in principle? I suspect the answer is no, but the matter is far from settled. Let me start the discussion by telling you two stories. My first story concerns Charles Babbage. He was one of the intellectual giants of his day, a mathematician, philosopher, mechanical engineer, and an inventor. He was Lucasian Professor of Mathematics at Cambridge University, a position that was once held by Isaac Newton and is currently occupied by Stephen Hawking. He had one additional advantage over both these men. He was outrageously rich. Today, we think of him as a father of the modern computer. In 1822, he proposed to the Royal Astronomical Society a machine to calculate mathematical and astronomical tables. He called it the Difference Engine. It would have 25,000 parts, weigh 15 tons, stand 8 feet tall, and be driven by steam. The British government gave him £1,700 to start. By the time the government had lost faith in the project, Babbage had received and spent £17,470, and the machine was nowhere near finished. About the same time, John Bull built the first steam locomotive for £784. Babbage had spent the equivalent of 22 locomotives. About the same time, Babbage had conceived of a better plan that would have been simpler to build with fewer parts. He called it Difference Engine Number 2. It was never built in his lifetime, but in 1991, the Science Museum of London built a difference engine from Babbage's original plans. It works flawlessly. It can evaluate seventh-order polynomials, store 8 numbers, and calculate to 31-digit accuracy. In 1837, Babbage proposed a mechanical general-purpose computer as the successor to his difference engine. It was called the analytical engine. It incorporated an arithmetic logic unit, control flow in the form of conditional branching and loops, and integrated memory, making it the first design for a general-purpose computer. In modern terminology, it was Turing complete. This means roughly that in principle, it could calculate anything that any other computer could calculate. It was not until the 1940s that the first general-purpose computers were actually built, more than a century after Babbage had proposed the pioneering analytical engine. Now let's switch to modern times. In 1997, IBM built a computer called Deep Blue, exclusively to play chess. It could evaluate 200 million chess positions per second and used as much power as a small village. It played a match with Garry Kasparov, the reigning world champion, and lost by a score of 4-2. The computer was then massively upgraded and won the next match by a score of 3.5-2.5. Kasparov accused IBM of cheating, in other words, using human players. IBM denied the charge. Kasparov demanded to see the computer program. IBM refused and promptly dismantled the computer. So did IBM cheat? Probably not. But that's not the point. The point is that a human player, who could evaluate perhaps 2 positions a second, could beat a computer that could evaluate 200 million. How is this possible? The easy answer is that they were the right 2. But how did he know? Let's start by thinking of the human brain as a kind of computer. In a previous talk, I told you a little bit about neurons and how they work. I described them in terms of electrical engineering and chemical engineering. Now, since we are talking about computers, let's look at neurons from the point of view of mathematics. The header to this talk is the sketch of the mathematics of a neuron. According to the electrical engineer, electrical signals are propagated through the dendrites to the body of the neuron. From the point of view of mathematics, they are just, well, quantities. In the diagram, they are labeled x1, x2, and so forth. Some of these quantities are larger than others, so we will indicate this with weights, here labeled w1, w2, and so forth. The reason some are larger than others is a result of the chemical calculations carried on by the synapses. In the diagram, they are labeled synaptic weights. It is speculated that memories are stored in this way. When you remember something, you are just summoning up a constellation of synaptic weights. Then these quantities are just added. That's the significance of the big sigma in the diagram. Depending how large the sum is, the neuron either does or does not send a signal onto the next neuron. This final decision is made by the activation function, here represented with a phi. And that's all there is to it. Just high school algebra, and high school algebra is something that computers are very good at. Perhaps we can make simple brains by running networks of these mathematical neurons on computers. There are philosophers who would like to take this further. They claim that the brain is nothing but a very complicated computer. This point of view is called connectionism. If this were true, if this were the whole story, there would not be much for the philosophers to do. We are conscious in the same way that computers are conscious. We have free will to the same extent that computers have it. We understand computers. After all, we build them. So by extension, we understand our minds. You have all heard of the branch of computer science called artificial intelligence, or AI for short. Is there really any important difference between artificial intelligence and our own? To explore this question, I would first like to give you some history of computers and artificial intelligence, then tell you about special kinds of computers called neural nets, and finally get back to the big philosophical questions. Calculating machines, for example, Babbage's analytic engine, are not a new idea. and when electronics with switches and vacuum cleaners were first developed, it became possible to make circuits that could calculate things. They had something in common with the mechanical calculators, however. If you wanted your calculating machine to calculate something different, you would have to rebuild it. If you wanted your calculating circuit to calculate something different, you would have to rewire it. The modern computer was born in 1945 with the idea that a calculating circuit could be made, in some sense, to rewire itself. The man who first envisioned this, the man who is usually given credit for inventing the modern computer, was John von Neumann. John von Neumann was born in Budapest in 1903 and moved to Princeton with his family in the mid-1930s. By the mid-1940s, he had invented game theory and the theory of automaton, which deals with the possibility that machines might be able to reproduce themselves. In the field of hydrodynamics, he developed a mathematical formalism for modeling shockwaves. These calculations were used in the Manhattan Project to develop detonators for nuclear weapons. He was also the author of the pivotal book on the mathematical foundations of quantum mechanics. A von Neumann computer consists of two parts, a memory unit and a central processor, or CPU. The memory stores two kinds of information, data in the form of binary numbers, and instructions that tell the CPU what to do with these numbers. The computer operates in well-defined cycles. First, fetch some specific data into the CPU, together with instructions that tell the processor what to do with these numbers. The result of the calculations are then stored back in memory, and the computer begins a new cycle. This is called the von Neumann architecture, and such a computer is said to be a serial machine, serial in the sense that it only does one thing at a time. This has been a successful strategy because modern computers are so phenomenally fast. There is something about it that seems wildly impractical, however. Suppose you were moving all your household possessions from New York to San Francisco. The von Neumann architecture corresponds to moving them one item at a time. Move a dress to San Francisco, then go back to New York, get a coat, and so forth. The speed at which signals travel in a computer is limited by the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. The speed at which signals travel in the brain is more like 100 yards, that is to say, the length of a football field, in 1 second. Clearly, the brain is not a serial machine. But remember, there are 1 million ganglion cells in the optic nerve. In some sense, the brain is doing 1 million things at once. This difference has motivated the development of neural net computers, which I will discuss eventually.